Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the programme.
And on ABC Local Radio around Australia, you with me, Noel DeBean. And coming up in this hour now, a rising hip-hop star. We don't do much of that on this programme, Emmanuel Jal. He was a young boy in southern Sudan when the Second Sudanese Civil War broke out. And he was about 7 years old when his own mother was killed by soldiers. He ended up joining thousands of children travelling to Ethiopia who'd been told they could get an education if they went there. Instead, they were all recruited by the Sudanese People's Liberation Army and taken off to military training camps to be turned into child soldiers. Emmanuel fought as a young boy with his AK-47, and the strife that he was in got more and more confused and violent, and in the end he ran away with some other child soldier recruits. At the age of 11, he was lucky enough to be found and rescued by Emma McCune, a British aid worker. She adopted him. Well, first she smuggled him out and into Kenya. She adopted him and sent him to school in Nairobi. But only months later, Emma McCune herself was killed tragically in a car accident. Well, Emmanuel ended up fending for himself again. And after years of trying to work out how to sort out life, get ahead, he ended up in music. And he had a big hit. His first big hit was All We Need Is Jesus. And if you know African culture, religion is very much to the forefront in many African nations. That was his first big hit in Kenya. It even got airplay in the UK. Well, he fell in love with hip-hop. Not the usual USA version. This is very Africanized hip-hop. And you're going to hear a bit of it in this hour, even though you may not be expecting to hear hip-hop on Sunday nights. His first album was Gwa, which was a mix of rap in the African languages of Arabic, English, Swahili, Dinka and Nuer. Nuer is the tribe he comes from. His next single was War Child, a personal one about himself, and it mixes rap and soul to produce what he calls a world music vibe. He tells his personal story constantly through the lyrics. There's also a documentary about Emmanuel called War Child, and it made its international debut at the Berlin Film Festival. Well, Emmanuel now works through his music for unity. He's trying to overcome ethnic and religious division, and he's trying to motivate the youth of his own people in the Sudan. He's sung for Nelson Mandela. He's an activist. He's a spokesman for Make Poverty History, a program campaign that we've been talking about on this program. He's also involved in the Coalition to Stop the Use of Child Soldiers and the Control Arms campaign. But he says his biggest passion is Gwa Africa, a charity that he founded, same name as his song, and it's involved in building schools, scholarships for Sudanese war survivors in refugee camps, and education for children in the most deprived slum areas in Nairobi.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon, and we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. And we cannot change the way people act, and we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax.
We want peace. There, the latest release from Emmanuel Jal. If you see the clip that goes with it, you'll see George Clooney, you'll see President Jimmy Carter, you'll see a whole lineup of people.
Alicia Keys,
there's lots and lots of people there. Which tells me that you've got connections, Emmanuel Jal, as a peace activist.
It's not about connection. It's just finding people with a common goal and common ground where they all wish the same. They want peace for the whole world. And so to make a call is not going to be difficult.
That song is sort of right at the root of what you do and who you are as a peace activist. And it comes out of your experience in Sudan, doesn't it? 50 years of war, 21 of continuous war. And I think you're the very first child soldier I've ever met. I've read about them, but you're the very first one I've ever met.
Ex-child soldier,
yes.
A lot of people always meet me, they still think I'm still a child soldier, but it's okay.
Tell us the story. How did you end up in the army at 9 years of age? Seven, actually.
Well, the story is similar to every young kid there. We were taken to Ethiopia that we were going to go to school. But a lot of us lost their homes, lost what they owned. Like me, my village was torn by the war. And we kept running from one place to another. The war reached the core of my family. So all my aunties, some of them died of diseases, curable diseases, and they have to run, hiding in the bush. My mother died all my uncle died in the war. I witnessed my aunt raped in front of me when I was 5. And so, thinking of the situation now and remembering, every moment is still fresh. It's still like it was yesterday.
There are stories in Africa that come out of terrible conflict. And in that sense, you told a litany of loss almost. There's many, many things you just said there which would, I think, even one of them would stagger a person. One of them could stagger a person. And then on top of all that dislocation of family, you're recruited into the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. What is that? What's its history? What was it trying to do?
Well, Sudanese People's Liberation Army, at that point, were the heroes standing out between us, between the government. So probably if it never came, I probably would be a slave now. And probably South Sudan would have been converted into Islam by force.
It represented the Christian South, basically.
Anybody with a liberal mind. I came to realize recently that there were Muslims in South Sudan too. But they are more free when they're in South Sudan. And so Christian non-believers. But the idea the government had was basically favoring people of a different background that call themselves Arabs. And those are the people that were the first class citizen. And every other person are classified. There's different stages of how people are classified.
Wherever you are in Africa, tribalism is an issue. And the divisions within Sudan are also going to be in part along tribal lines, some Christian, some Muslim as well, so religion gets added into it as well. As I understand it, the Dinka are the largest group of people, I think, in the south, who are basically Christian. Your Nuer, basically Christian group. And religion has somehow wound itself into this as well, because I remember reading something you said that when you were a child soldier, what you wanted to do was kill Muslims.
Yeah, my desire was to kill as many Muslims and Arabs as possible in the training camp. I wanted to revenge for my family members. And you see, the training was not easy. But the force that made me finish my training was the things that I saw, because they flash in my eyes. I see my mother scream, and I don't know where my brothers and sisters are. And I say, this is a moment for me to revenge. And so that's what helped me endure and finish the training.
You did the training, you were recruited. What did you do once you had finished your training?
We actually went back and went to school. The bigger boys were collected and they actually went to the battlefields. They were lied to, they're being taken to Cuba, Kenya, and everybody was excited. Then you just want to jump, you don't know the people were being taken to the battlefields. So I came to realize later, some of my friends, my age has gone up and Ethiopia was overthrown, that these guys were not actually taken to Kenya or Cuba. They were actually taken to Equatorial battlefield.
Your friend David Vincent, you met him in Ethiopia.
Yes.
You formed a very close friendship, didn't you, you and David?
Yes.
As I understand the story about David Vincent, you had survived terrible things in the refugee camp.
Yes.
With him.
Yeah.
And we're talking about lack of basic medicine, lack of food, violence, all sorts of things to be endured. And you were very close through that, but you got separated. How did the separation happen?
The separation happened in the training, when we were training. I think he actually was trained before me. And they never told me the truth where they went, so they were excited. And when I went for the second round of big training, it wasn't a good place to be in.
So you two were separated, but there's also now another person who comes into the story, Emma McCune, isn't there?
Yes.
Emma McCune was a British aid worker who met you.
Well, I met Emma McCune on one of the journey we tried to escape on the failed battle of Juba. So we were like 400 young people mixed with adults, and only 16 people survived that journey. And in that journey, this is one of the lowest points as a human being I was reduced to, because I was tempted to eat my friend when we ran out of food. And after this journey, I met Emma McCune in a place called Wat. And that's when she smuggled me to Kenya.
Out of 400 people, 16 survived.
Yes.
You were walking.
We were walking.
And you say you were tempted, you even thought of having to eat somebody.
Yes, my senses changed. We had the magician that was with us, he started eating dead bodies and roasting them. And so for me, my senses sit next to my fellow human being, they smell like food.
So there was a companion with you. who was eating human flesh. Is that what you're saying?
Cannibalism began. Even there were some of the soldiers who I met later and were telling me they found one of our guys stuck in the bush eating dead bodies, and they were telling him to stand. He wasn't able to stand. People who actually ate dead bodies committed suicide. Some lost their minds. They couldn't take it anymore. You've gone to the battlefields. Probably you've killed. You've gone through so much. You've lost your family members. And now you've been forced to eat a human being, which doesn't happen in your culture. So psychologically, how do you get a way out of that?
At the end of that journey you've described, I think you met Emma McCune. And she decided she was going to help you, a British aid worker. How old were you, by the way, at this stage when you met Emma?
I was 12, turning 13. My AK was longer than me. It was dragging the ground.
You're carrying your AK-47 gun?
Yeah.
When you met
her? I had two. One from my friend who died, and one which is mine, which was actually really humiliating for me because they sold my gun for cows for soldiers to eat.
There's a part of me that would... if I hadn't been to Africa, say, oh, you're just making this up, because it's so outrageous, it's so shocking what you're saying, but I know what you're telling me is true. I've heard some stories which are not dissimilar to this about how upside down things can be. Now, you met Emma, you're carrying your AK-47, and I think I've had this experience too, where you just start talking to a kid. If you're in, say, you're in Nairobi, you're in the Kibera, you start talking to a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, and suddenly, within 24 hours, you discover your friends, and you've decided you're going to help them somehow. You're going to get them some medical attention, or you're going to help them find their parents, or you're going to... I've had that experience. Is this how it happened? She just took a liking to you? You just looked at each other and went,
I don't know. She rescued over 150 child soldiers previously, putting them in school.
But she adopted you, didn't she?
We did not actually talk. I don't know. She adopted me, yes. I'm the only one that she managed to take with and be with all the time.
So there was something about you and her in your relationship that clicked.
There was no even relationship. It's the look, you know. I think sometimes you could go to a place, you cannot even communicate, but you look at the person and you just want to help them. Like sometimes the story of a child is painted in their eye, in their face, either through their smile or... And they just decided, there were other kids, but both of them decided to pick on me. Two people, they should have split themselves. You take the other one, take the other one. But they said, we want to take this guy. And that's what they were interested in.
So it's just one of the mysteries of life, that it was just a connection. And you and Emma were somehow connected, and she decided she was going to help you, Emmanuel. And she was going to smuggle you into Kenya.
The fact that she risked her life to smuggle me, breaking a law of another country to bring another child into it, that's deep. I don't understand why she chose me. I cannot explain it. Why? It's like you go to an orphanage, a kid has grown up later, then you ask them, why were you picked? How will you explain that? You can't.
How did she get you into Kenya? What, were you in a car? Were you
on a plane? The way she did it is the only thing I see on movies. She dressed nice and she was pretty. She looked like a model. And everybody's attention was on her. She put on perfume so she smelled nice if you're standing where the wind is. And she was engaging all the soldiers. And everybody's laughing. I use my basic soldier skills and I cripple into the plane. That's how we escaped. There were no cameras.
You snuck into the plane?
Yeah. I crawl with the bags, so the bags are being pushed, and that's it. When I arrived in Kenya, when I was getting off the plane, because it was illegal, I had to use the same formula. She come out, the pilot, and everyone was confusing, the policeman, Jambo, everybody talking, I was out. And the same way. I don't know how to...
What sort of plane was it? Give me a picture.
It's those UN plane.
A UN plane,
yeah.
Right. And so she's busy... tossing her hair and looking winsome while the soldiers are chatting to her, and you're sneaking around the back into the plane.
Yeah. Actually, when we leave, she had her bodyguards before in the airport, so our bodyguard played a little part into the action of creating confusion. The part that was really difficult was in the canyon, because we have to shift into different planes. So when I arrive in Kenya, I look like a Turkana kid. So... because they all run in the airport anyway. So yeah. When I was getting out of the plane, so I had to crawl and then sit under the tree like I'm nobody, just like a little kid in the airport. And then when the turn come to coming, the same trick, we tried it again, and it worked in Lokichokyo. Then I arrived in Nairobi. It was a different story.
Now, in Nairobi, I presume you went to stay with her?
Yeah.
But like many stories you hear in Africa, there's not the best outcome here again, because she was accidentally killed not so long after you had met her.
It's a difficult, sensitive story to talk about because it's really difficult on what happened. So I don't know how to put it, but it's really difficult.
You were alone again, though.
Yeah, I became alone again, my world crashed again, and that's when music came to life.
When you were separated again, and Emma was gone, where did you go?
I stayed in her husband's house, Dr. Riek Machar, but Dr. Riek Machar was in the field, so in the house I was not getting treated well, and so I escaped, sometimes get beaten, so I left the house and I was in the slums. I go to the church, back to the slums, I got different people. I stayed in a ghetto where we're like 8 people in one room, we eat and shower in the same place, in a Kenyan family who took me into their house. I stayed in Kaungware and Kangemi.
These are big settlements sort of on the edge of town, basically.
Yeah, there are a lot of ghettos around Nairobi.
Yeah. Tin sheds, basically.
Made of mud with tin.
Yep. You began your music in that context?
No, later on, actually, my music began in 1998 when I started living in a much better place.
This was still in Kenya?
Yeah.
So you managed to make do somehow? How did you improve your lot? How did you get ahead?
Well, different people come and support. I've been having an interesting life, you know. I've been very lucky. Each time I meet somebody, you know, they want to help without me doing so much, and they just want to help.
In terms of your music, when I saw your clip, We Want Peace, I saw some really very influential people. Kofi Annan made an appearance. Jimmy Carter made an appearance. Annie Lennox makes an appearance. There's lots of people making appearances. That tells me that between just surviving in Nairobi and now, there's been a lot of music making. There's been a lot of progress.
I have 3 albums out there. So at the moment, I'm pushing out my 4th album, but each time I want to push out an album, there's an incident that I want to play part, so I become an activist of that part and try to push that message. The album was supposed to be released in December, but because December last year,
yeah.
But the problem, because my country had issues, so I wanted to focus on the peace. Then when things goes quiet, I can actually release my album. So George Clooney and Alicia Keys, Peter Gabriel, they all came because we wanted to put light into the darkness so that the evil can perform less. That's what I normally believe. If people know about what is going on, they'll talk about it. And talking about it is also another way of putting fear to the people who want to commit the atrocities, because they know somebody knows. You see, people want to do things when somebody doesn't know.
I'm trying to work out, I suppose, trying to get an understanding of your path from a boy who was rescued from a camp, smuggled into Kenya, a clever boy, by the way, if he managed to get onto a plane, and then and then sneak off a plane again. And I know airport...
It's just the basic soldier skill. You're trained to escape or attack. It's just the same way.
Well, you made it out. But in 10 years, it seems that you've gone from a kid with perhaps not much hope, really, as an outsider looking on, maybe not much hope, even if you were confident and you were going to go for it. What was your path to making, really starting to make really good music, becoming a recording artist? How did you do it?
It happened in Kenya when I got one big hit. Actually, I did not know what I put myself into. I was doing it because it's fun.
Right.
But I did not know it was something that can pay my bills. So I got paid $200 one point. I said, first money in my life, my own money. It was too much for me. I did not know how to begin.
What did you do with it?
I shared it with my friends and everybody. We had fun. And then another time was called, and then I was given $500. And I said, wow, so there's something. So, and I wasn't even a good performer then. So, and it kept on rising, and the pay kept on rising. And then, wow, I said, look, I'm not ready for this. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to go to school. So it was difficult.
So you basically formed a career in music in Kenya. That's where you first became big.
So I'm an African artist who have become successful.
In
from
Africa.
Africa. And out of it, I didn't even get time to develop myself. I just got one hit. Kenyans went crazy. I started to get paid. The international people and Kenyan did not know who this was. They thought I was a Kenyan. When they discovered my story, BBC, everywhere.
They're all over it.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And then America, New York Times, or how do you call it, USA Today. And that was it. I was invited for Live Aid. I performed. The promoter said, oh, this is cool music. They booked me for shows. And since then, I never went back to actually spend 1 month just waiting in Kenya.
You've been working ever since.
I've been working ever since, and responsibilities started growing. So I started investing in Gua Africa.
This is your charity,
yes.
Gua Africa. Yeah.
I was started involve myself with Amnesty, Oxfam to try to create awareness.
Make poverty history.
Yes.
Yep.
And so many things started coming on, and up to now, Nelson Mandela, I started meeting big leaders. I didn't even know the people I meet because I did not even know what it is. I was new in the industry. I meet a famous person today. Oh, this is so nice to meet you.
Yes.
First time I met Angelina Jolie, my manager almost knocked my head down because I did not know who Angelina Jolie was. So, hi, my name is Angelina. Okay, nice to meet you. And I passed on to my manager, do you know this woman? She can save your life. I said, so what? How? So, like...
Well, she's been very active in Africa, hasn't she, Angelina? She's been really trying to do
Angelina
stuff.
Angelina Jolie, I actually met her again recently. She's very honest. There are few people that are really honest in the place. The people who do it because they are doing it from their heart. And she's one of those people.
So we should play your hit, you know.
Yeah.
This is what you named your charitable institution after.
Yeah.
What? And on ABC Radio around Australia, you with me, Noel Debien, and my guest in studio is Emmanuel Jal, a former Sudanese child soldier, now a hip-hop artist and a star. Emmanuel Jal, that was Gua, your first big Kenyan hit. And if I'm understanding right now, you become a rock star basically in Kenya, and then from that, people start chasing you, including they come and introduce themselves to you, saying, I want to meet you. But the thing that you do, which is, I think, unusual when it comes to being, you know, a star, is you're an activist, you're a peace activist. You've not just gone to make money. You've not just said, well, I've put all that behind me and I'll just be happy now and have a lot of money. What you've done is you've established a charity, a charitable foundation. You've involved yourself in Make Poverty History, and you are a peace activist. Why?
The thing is, when I look at it, money alone does not motivate me to do anything. Buying a big house, having a nice car, and it doesn't. When I think about it, it doesn't. But what motivates me is my past. And seeing other children suffering. And saying, look, I have this platform. What is my pride if my motherland people are walking naked? You know, what is my pride for me to start bling and feel that I'm so important when my grandmother is going blind or my people are naked on TV? And that's what keeps me humble. Because my pride is in my people, is in how my people live and how they are. And so when I put myself, look, I'm a messenger. This temptation, it's not easy to be in an industry where you want to focus on just your message, because who's going to buy your record?
Yeah,
that's what the record label
was. We've still got to make good music, you know.
Nobody wants to. Some of them don't think it's good music. Someday I was performing somewhere and a record executive came and said, look, this looks like a charity event. Nobody's going to buy this kind of music. It's too painful.
It looks like a charity event, he said.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was a put down.
Yeah, and so what happened is when I get a chance and perform in a big concert with big names, the press would write about my performance, calling it electrical. Yeah, so I performed with Alicia Keys, and then the press wrote about me more. Sometimes the music I have is, it's slightly different. The words are strong, but that's what the music was in the 80s, 60s. And that's when the music that helped civil rights movement, like if you talk about Lennon, Bob Marley, they were deep people. They're not talking about simple stuff.
Oh, they had a message, all right. Yeah.
And so what they tell me is, the DJ said, look, your music is too real, we can't play it.
It's too real?
Yeah. And I said, what about hip-hop that are shooting guns and poof and talking about it? He said, this is acting, but in musical format. But what you're saying is real. We don't want to change people's minds. We want them to dance, be happy. Yours is too terrifying. But when I perform live and people come, somebody who's a rock artist or blues, they don't come with expectation. But when they leave, they say, I don't like hip-hop, but you make me like hip-hop. Because...
Well, I don't like hip-hop, but you make me like hip-hop. So there you go. You've got another convert. But can you give me an example of a song that's too terrifying? What sort of thing? Because I'd like to play some to see what this guy was on about.
Emma, the song called Emma.
Emma.
Dedicated to Emma McCune. This one goes to Emma McCune. Angel to the rescue one afternoon. I'm here because you rescued me. I'm proud to carry your legacy. Thank you. Bless you. R.I.P.
What would I be?
And on ABC Radio Around Australia, you're with me, Noel Debien. My guest is Emmanuel Jarl, former Sydney's child soldier, now a hip-hop artist, rising star. And that song there was Emma. Emmanuel Jarl, dedicated for Emma McCune.
Dedicated to Emma McCune. It's one of the deepest songs. I performed it at Nelson Mandela concert, and people loved it.
It strikes me that many times I've heard rapping, I've heard hip-hop, I've heard this stuff, and I think, oh, this is all fake, it's all acting. And the unusual and the striking thing about your music is it's coming out of a really serious and personal life experience. That's what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about religion?
Well, for me, like, faith is what gives me hope to want to see tomorrow, and music is my painkiller. So in one of my journeys, I almost ate my friend, but I prayed, God, if you're there, give me something to eat. And so I gave God a chance to prove himself, and if he wasn't going to be there, I'm going to eat my friend. And so along my journey, there are some questions that I don't find answers for. But I came to realize when I pray or meditate, it gives me so much peace, and it keeps me humble, and it gives me hope tomorrow is going to be better. And so I came with a conclusion and said, look, I'd rather believe there is God and find out there's no God than believe there is no God and find there is God. So for any person who's suffering anywhere, there have to be something for hope. If there's nothing that gives you hope to want to see tomorrow, then what's the reason to be alive?
I understand, I think, but my question still niggling away inside is, as a child, you were given an AK-47 and you wanted to kill Muslims. It was framed in religious terms where Christians were going to kill Muslims. What's left of Christianity for you?
There was no person that was saying this is Christians and Muslims war. Everybody saw what was done to them.
Right. It was a revenge thing.
By going to school, I came to know what was killing us was not Muslims and Arabs. It's the gold, the oil, the diamond, and the land. The same thing the tribes were fighting for.
They say I'm going to kill Muslims, but in fact it's an argument about territory, or it's an argument about oil, or it's an argument about political control.
In my village, we used to believe Dinka eat people. That's my tribe. And so I grew up as a young little boy, learning how to fight, and one day I'm going to raid Dinka cows because they don't deserve it. And the Dinka too had their own belief that...
The Nuer ate Dinka, maybe?
No, we are not human. We don't deserve the cows, so they come and raid us. And so when I look at that, what different is that when Arabs came, 600 after Christ, the land was given to them by Allah, and we are slaves. It's God will that we become slaves, and they started enslaving people. And what's different is that with European colonizing Africa. So you see the similarity. So the reality is people extend the empathy to people of the same color or same faith as them. And Christians here will feel for Christians, empathize for Christians more than Muslims. And Muslims will empathize for Muslims. Mm. And that's how the world is divided.
You're an African philosopher. You've turned into a philosopher.
The reality probably turned me into a philosopher. But the truth is, if there is God, he loves everybody. Mm. And we are all his children. So religion has been used as a tool to control and to divide people. But the benefit people will benefit are some greedy people who knows how to cooperate behind the scene. But they use the poor to kill each other. It's hard to see a rich Muslim fighting a rich Christian. One thing that almost made me lose my mind, you know, like when we arrived in the refugee camps, was 6-7 years old burying their own dead. Nobody was to answer that question.
Burying their own dead at 6 and 7 years of age?
Yeah. We ran out of food. We were starving. We make our own prayers to bury our own dead. You got like 15,000 to 20,000 young people that are cooking for themselves and taking care of themselves. And so at here, question that could easily be answered, make kids lose their mind. Mm. And one thing that made me almost blow my mind was, how did they make the bags of maize? You know, like this, yep. The maize are put in certain bags. And that triggered more question. How did they make car? Nobody was able to answer. Who's God? Where is he? Why are we suffering? And then the whole night I was just talking to myself. And my head was paining and paining and paining. Luckily, I survived. Because I saw kids who, when they start asking those questions, they'll cry the whole night, they'll beat the world, nobody's there. And then the next thing, they remove their clothes and then they started shitting everywhere and applying shit on their body and running around. And then the next thing you
complete
see...
Complete breakdown, basically.
They commit suicide. Or maybe they get a knife and start starving people. It starts slowly, but what the aid workers used to do is they tie them down and they inject them with something.
To calm them.
By the time they wake up tomorrow, they're fine.
Despite that horror that you're describing now, you believe there's a God.
That's what keeps me going. That's giving me strength. You know, it's not easy to live in this world. Some people do yoga to make themselves happy. They go upside down, do all ridiculous things. It gives them happiness. So faith, there's something it does to me. It helped me. It built a mechanism inside me to keep me happy. Despite when somebody upsets me, I'll be upset for 2 minutes. But the next time I see them again, I don't hold it. So, you know, education helped me to educate myself, to understand, to heal. Mm. If I never went to school and be able to read for myself, I would not heal.
Now, you've kept your interest in Sudan. You said to me you want to go back. But South Sudan is in crisis even now.
It could bring both countries back to war. Then we have tribalism, which is sensitive.
And it's only this year, though, that the accord was signed. It's only months, really, isn't it?
It's months. But the good thing is there is hope. Is there's the Lost Boys, most of the ex-child soldiers that have left the country, that have been given opportunity in America, Australia, all over the world, are like-minded. So now they are beginning to try to influence their tribes, and they're working within the government. And we're trying our best now to say, look, we have to put an end to tribalism. We have to begin to unite. And if the government is doing nothing, it's us and our children who are going to suffer. If Arabs invade us again, will our children be enslaved?
Well, you're already engaged in peace activism. Even as you talk now, I can see that it's very much at the front of your mind. You've got lots more to do in Australia here. I can see Adelaide, you've got stuff on October 14th. October 16th and 17th, you've got workshops with Multicultural Arts Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a screening of War Child on October 18th. You've got a hip-hop summit on October 21st. And you've got Melbourne International Arts Festival on October 22nd at the Maya Music Bowl. Manuel Jal, thank you very much for spending some time with us. And thank you for telling us some of your story.
What I'm really passionate about is education, more than just advocating for peace, because that's the long-term solution to help many. Emotional intelligence, social-emotional learning. Back at home, what we need is intellectual education giving us tools.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.